Patsy Michener, a slave from the time when our country participated in that evil institution, looked back on those years after the Civil War and commented, "Slavery was a bad thing, and freedom, of the kind we got with nothing to live on, was bad. Two snakes full of poison, one lying with its head pointing north, the other with its head pointing south. Their names were slavery and freedom." I wonder if the slave girl in today's story felt the same way after being freed from the spirit that had possessed her. I have wrestled mightily with this story from the book of Acts this week. It's part of the chapters that take place in Macedonia when the apostles Paul and Silas heed a vision telling them to go to that area, today's northern Greece, to bring the good news of the gospel to the Jews and Gentiles there. Just before today's story, Paul and Silas meet Lydia, a woman who deals in purple cloth, who hears the message, invites them into her home, and is baptized along with all her household. These two women, Lydia and the slave girl, provide quite the contrast. One is named, wealthy, free, in charge of her own household, which was likely filled not only with servants, but also with slaves. The other is unnamed, possessed by a spirit and owned by men, a slave with no agency of her own, who is freed by the apostles and then forgotten. The man we call Luke wrote the book of Acts, and from his perspective, the point of this story arc is Paul and Silas and the conversion of faith of Lydia and the jailer. 90% of the commentaries that you will read about this story will say that. But I can't let go of this slave girl and how she has been glossed over or ignored over the centuries. At the beginning of this story, Luke writes, "One day we met a slave girl who had a spirit of divination and brought her owners a great deal of money by fortune telling. While she followed Paul, she would cry out, 'These men are slaves of the Most High God, who proclaim to you a way of salvation.'" Now, one of the interesting things here are the different Greek words that are translated slave. For Paul and his companions, the word is doulos, which is translated throughout the New Testament as either slave or servant. Paul often identifies himself as the slave or servant of Christ, and the word can imply a sense of honor in serving someone who is great. For the girl possessed by the spirit, Luke uses a different word, paideske. It's a specific word for a young female, and in the King James translation, it's translated either as damsel or maiden, which seems to miss the whole point. She is not a damsel in distress. As a child, as a female, and as a slave, she lives at the bottom of society. She is owned by other people, and she has value simply because people will pay her owners so that she will tell their fortunes. But once she is freed from the spirit that enabled her to see the future, she's of no value to her owners, and her great liberators, Paul and Silas, are in jail, and they never connect with her again. The chances are likely that she was abandoned both by her owners and by her liberators. She would have to fend for herself, and in those days, living on her own in the streets, in 6 months, she would probably be dead. I appreciate what commentator Mitzi Smith says. Some readers will conclude that as a result of the exorcism, the slave girl is free. Free to do what in a slave society? A useless slave did not become a freed slave, but as an exposed slave, she was left to fend for herself with no means to take care of herself. Yes, the owners profited from her gifts. And yes, slavery is wrong, no matter where it is found, on the pages of sacred text or on American soil. Paul and Silas treated the girl similarly to how her masters treated her, as an object that annoyed them, but not as a human being. Dr. Smith concludes, our mission should never condone inhumane treatment of other persons. It is easier to treat the nameless in inhumane ways, to be indifferent toward those for whom we have no names, to render them invisible, or to treat them as pawns in the war between good and evil. Do we do that? Do we accomplish our good deed, fulfill our mission, feel good about ourselves, and then forget those affected by our actions? It's a difficult question to ask. It's hard not to think of our military veterans in regards to this question. We send our young men and women off to war, and perhaps they win the battle or even the war, and then they come home. Some of them battle-scarred, shell-shocked, we used to call it. Some of them come home with post-traumatic stress syndrome, and too many of our veterans end up on the street struggling with health issues or mental illness or addiction brought about by their experience serving in that battle or that war. A study conducted in the first decade of this century concluded that there were 22 veteran suicides every day, one every 65 minutes. We may have won the war, but at what cost? Years ago, when I was serving my first church, I became involved with the fabulous Habitat for Humanity. A family in our congregation had put in the hard work of sweat equity, and they were finally going to receive their Habitat home. The mother was raising her 6 children by herself, having left her abusive husband and having left the more restricted Wisconsin Synod Lutheran Church and found our more welcoming Presbyterian Church. Their house was part of a blitz build where they put up a house in about 3 days over a weekend, and they were so happy when they moved in. I left that church to take a new call, but through the grapevine, I heard a little bit later that the house had problems. The foundation hadn't been poured properly. There was a crack in it. The house leaned. There was mold. And then the mother died, and the oldest child, who was then 18, was left to take care of her siblings and to pay off the mortgage. They were in so many ways forgotten. Once they had a roof over their heads, they would be all right, right? No, not at all. There's a saying that no good deed goes unpunished, but I fear that too often the one who is punished is not the doer of the deed, but the recipient of the deed. And I know that we can do better. Of course, there is a different way that the story of the slave girl might have ended. It's possible that she was not left to fend for herself on the streets. It's possible that the church in Philippi, the city in which she practiced her trade, took her in and acted like the church. Maybe those who were part of the Philippian congregation got word of this slave girl, exercised of her spirit and abandoned by her owners, and maybe they took her in and cared for her and included her in their community. Years later, you'll remember that Paul wrote that congregation in Philippi from prison and told them that remembering them brought him great joy despite his adverse circumstances. He wrote that his prayer for them was that their love would flow more and more with knowledge and full insight to help them determine what would be best. Paul encouraged the Philippians to have humility so that they regarded others as better than themselves. He reminded them that they were children of God in a perverse and crooked generation where they shone like stars in the world. And maybe when he wrote them these words, he remembered this slave girl and how the congregation took her in. Maybe. We'll never know. So, what does it mean for us to act like the church? To be humble enough to regard others as better than ourselves? To shine like stars in the world? Maybe we start by noticing those whom the world has forgotten, the veterans on the streets, the children separated from their parents in detention centers along the border, the strangers we see or read about who have no name because no one will claim them. And maybe we take stock of our ministry. Think about those who we thought we helped once upon a time, and then ask ourselves if we still know them and if we know how they're doing, and ask ourselves if we ever truly invited them into our community. Now, suppose a couple comes to our door and tells us that they're hungry. Can we help them? We might give them $20. We might find them some cookies or fruit from coffee hour. We might direct them to Grace Meals or to Northeast Emergency Food Program. We might realize that they're not only hungry, but they're unemployed or underemployed, and maybe they're couch surfing, relying on the kindness of friends and acquaintances for a place to stretch out at night. And maybe as we consider all these things, we realize that there's some big systems in place that need to be changed, that having a job is one thing, but earning a living wage is another, that having a roof over your heads is one thing, but being part of a community is something else altogether. And maybe as we sit with them in the great hall or talk with them under the red awning, we introduce ourselves and we ask them their names. And maybe we take them to lunch and hear part of their story. And then, do we wish them well and go home and figure our work here is done? I think that sometimes we meet people whose lives are so different from our own that we never forget them. It might be that the differences between us make us really uncomfortable. And it might be that those differences make us feel guilty or envious. It might be that we feel mad or bewildered that there are people who live in a way so different from the way we live. And when you meet someone like that, I hope you will remember the story of this slave girl in Acts 16. Oftentimes, we can never know the end of someone's story. But sometimes, we can change the trajectory of a story. We can free this girl and then abandon her, or we can free her and welcome her in. That choice is before us almost every day. So what will it be?